Time for another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Our guest today is Kevin Esperito. He's the founder of the Epic Gardening website, podcast, and YouTube channel. So we'll be talking with him about starting a garden from scratch and help you, of course, with your gardening questions. Maybe you're a new gardener. What's that experience been like for you? Do you need help starting a garden at a new location? Love to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Kevin Esperito, welcome. Great to have you back for the show.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having me again.
Well, you've been with us, of course, before, but refresh our memory about your gardening background. How'd you get started?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I didn't grow up as a gardener like I think many people do. I grew up in Southern California and was just, you know, a skateboarder, surfer, was really into science as a kid, but only got into gardening when I was about 21 or 22 coming out of college. And I just kind of needed something to get me back in touch with nature because I was spending a lot of time on the computer and didn't really have a direction, so to speak. And so gardening kind of came out of the woodworks and ended up doing it that summer with my brother, and I've been hooked ever since.
Yeah. So what were some of the most important lessons from those maybe early attempts at growing plants?
Yeah, the first plant I ever started out with was the cucumber, and I grew it in a hydroponic system, so without soil. It was kind of it was a pretty ambitious start. So I learned a lot then about, you know, all the different things that a plant actually needs to survive, you know, light, water, nutrients, oxygen, all that stuff, kind of from the scientific perspective. And yeah, I mean, to me, it was the realization that the plant is growing itself. Our job as the gardener is to give it the things it needs to grow. We're not really responsible for its growth. We're sort of just managing that process.
That's a good way to look at it. So how did you, you've got a lot of expertise in this area. How'd you acquire it all? Was it just experience?
Yeah, it was a mixture of experience. Early on in my early 20s, when I first started, I was really fortunate. I got to work under Mel Bartholomew of Square Foot Gardening.
Oh,
He was in my city at the time, and I was doing a lot of web design. And so his Square Foot Gardening Foundation, his nonprofit, needed some help. Back then, I had no clue who Mel was. And so looking back, it was really kind of a fortuitous connection to be able to mentor under him for a couple of years. So I picked up a lot from him, a lot from books, and of course, I think as all gardeners know, a lot from my own mistakes.
Yeah, for sure. And you just moved into a new house, if I'm not mistaken, and you had to start your garden from scratch. How's that going?
Yeah, that's been a project. I think last time we talked, I was growing in my old house, which is only about, 200 square foot of growing space in the front yard. And now I have about 12,000 square feet to conquer. So most of it's bare right now. I've been slowly moving down the garden. It's been a bit of a challenge, but it's been fun.
Oh, my goodness me. And I'm betting that you chose that house for its gardening potential.
Yeah, when I saw it pop up on the listings, I drove down and I barely even looked at the actual home, and I just looked at the lot and I said, okay, this is the one I want.
Oh, so what advice do you have for gardeners who are starting from scratch?
Yeah, if you're starting from complete scratch, I would say you really want to start somewhat small. I mean, I know that I'm not the best example because I went with hydroponic cucumbers right out of the gate, but I would always say, you know, pick the plants that you really love the most, whether it's to eat or to look at. You know, say you really like spinach, for example, then that's the one you should grow, even if it's a difficult plant. Let's say you're trying to grow, tomatoes or peppers. Those are a little more challenging than spinach. But if you really love to grow it and you really love to eat it, then you're way more invested in it at the start. I think a lot of people get into the trap of growing a plant just because they heard it's an easy one to grow, but they don't necessarily even like that in their kitchen. And so that's one of the tips that I find helps people a lot.
Yeah, for sure. And some people are not... they're not only starting a new garden, but they're new to gardening. And what advice do you have for them?
Yeah, if you're new to gardening, it almost is. It is a similar piece of advice. I mean, just choose something that gets you excited about it, because I think the thing that keeps people gardening is seeing success, and the thing that gets people, you know, falling off and it just becomes a hobby that they once did is they tried it and they failed, but they don't really know what went wrong, and so they don't even know how to fix it. And that's why you see a lot of people dropping off of gardening year after year. I think probably especially this year, as a lot of us were, you know, stuck at home and picking up hobbies that we never thought we would start. And a lot of people, that was gardening. And so I'm hoping that a lot of the people that started this year will continue. And part of that is just trying to get as much success as you can. So again, growing those simple plants that you love to eat. That's really the connection for me.
Yeah. Well, we have callers online to visit with you, and maybe we should take a call or so here. Nancy in Madison, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if we can help. I like to bring pollinators to my front and back of the house. 5 years ago, I planted some lupins in the back, but they're not doing very well. The red one actually did not come back last year. They're 5 years old. And the white one has produced two small plants, but were not big enough to produce a flower spike. And since I'm looking at native plants here from Wisconsin, I don't know, being from California, if you know anything about lupins.
The only thing I know about lupins, I was in New Zealand a long time ago, and lupins are prolific there. Super beautiful flower. But yeah, I haven't grown them here. I think they're a zone 3 to 7 range, and I'm over here in zone 10B. So I've yet to grow them, but man, they are a beautiful plant.
So we'll have to take a pass on that, Nancy, but thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary in Milwaukee will turn to you. Hi, Mary.
Hey. So background is I've spent my entire life gardening. I think of it more as planting things and hoping they grow. But in the Milwaukee area, which is obviously all clay soil, very heavy, really hard to dig, we recently purchased a place out in the Spring Green area, and we use it like in the summer, but the soil there is completely different. It is sandy as all get out. It's like clay sand almost. And so I'm just looking for any tips or suggestions on making the adjustment from clay to planting in that sand.
Yeah, so I've got clay over here in San Diego. That's my main issue is a compacted clay. And the way I've solved that one is adding as much compost as I can. Sometimes I come in with a till, but it sounds like you have a mixture of clay and sand. And honestly, the way I would probably approach that is very similar. I'd be adding as much organic matter as I could because the sand's not holding on to it. The drainage is probably somewhat high with that sand. And the clay sounds like it's not as heavy as where you are right now. And so compost, generally speaking, is a good remedy for both soils too heavy in clay and too heavy in sand. So that's what I would be trying.
Yeah. And in terms of compost, anything that you recommend or whatever's available?
Yeah, it's hard to say, right? Because down here in San Diego, I can get a lot of well-aged horse manure that works really well for me. Or I can just go to my local municipality and grab their compost program that they have. And it's kind of just, if you're a resident, you can haul it away. So I would say as many mixed sources as you can possibly get, but the more local, the better, because it just tends to perform better in my experience.
Yeah. Mary, does that help?
Is there a good ratio of compost to the soil that's there?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's say you were taking your native soil and improving it. Typically what I would do is I would say about 50% of the native soil, around 25% of compost, and then the other 25% can be any source of organic matter that you can find that's somewhat close or inexpensive, like grass clippings, straw, shredded leaves, anything like that, worm castings. You can add that in as well, or you can just top it off with more compost.
Yeah, there you go. Mary, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Jeff in Door County has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I have a question about tilling. As far as like, is too much? I've heard that oftentimes it brings weed seeds up. And just how should you handle tilling in general when it comes to like vegetable gardens and things like that?
Yeah, sure. That's a really good question. So there's sort of this competing ideologies out there right now where there's the tilling movement and then there's the no-till, or we call it the no-dig movement. So I've done both, and I've visited farms who have done both. And honestly, both work. I tend a little bit more towards tilling once to improve your soil the very first time you're working in it. And then I try to never till again after that. And the reason why is because, number one, you are right. You will bring up some of those weed seeds. For me, I'm dealing with weeds that propagate via rhizome. And so if I till, I'm actually chopping them up into a bunch of little pieces, which then propagates them even further. So I'm kind of exacerbating the problem there. And then at the same time, you know, once you till and improve that soil and you're really taking care of it, there is an entire ecosystem that's going on beneath the soil that if we till year after year, we completely destroy it and it has to rebuild itself. And so that's kind of the way I approach it. You know, I wouldn't begrudge anyone for tilling every year or not tilling every year, but that's kind of just my philosophy.
Yeah. Jeff, does that help? No, I think we lost Jeff. But that was a good question. Thank you. Well, they're all good questions, actually. Matt in Madison emailed that she loves your YouTube channel, and he wants to know what's been your biggest challenge from moving from your smaller space to a larger space.
Oh man, the biggest challenge I would say is in the smaller space, I knew what I had to do because there's only so much space. And so I knew how many beds I could fit. I knew exactly the best way to fit them. I knew even down to the plants I could or couldn't grow. So let's say I wanted to grow some pumpkins for this Halloween. Well, I had to say, okay, well, if I'm growing pumpkins, that's going to take up 25% of my whole garden. And so is it worth it? Whereas here, as I look out over the property right now, I can have a 30-tree orchard. I could have a complete functioning urban farm. So there's so many options. The biggest challenge is figuring out what to do and then which ones to do first.
Oh, there you go. Gary in Iron River emailed to ask when he can dig up his established daffodil bulbs and move them. Also, does he need to do anything with them or can he replant them immediately? And when is it too early to plant new daffodil and crocus bulbs this fall? He's in zone 3-4.
I wish I had a better answer for that one. Especially flowers, but I'm getting more into bulbs, but I just haven't done a whole lot with them. My intuition would say that as they die off in the fall, it's time, like they're going to put their energy into the bulb, and then you can move them at that point in time, and then in spring it would come up. But again, I haven't grown daffodils. I'm only now getting into a bunch of ornamental annual perennial flowers as I move into this new space.
Yeah, and I think that's good advice. I think if you let those established daffodil, the leaves die, and then is a good time to move them because you want those leaves to be, you know, putting as much, getting as much sunlight to put into the roots as they can, and once that's over, then go ahead and move them. So there mm-hmm. you go. Makes good sense. Kevin Esperito, our guest today, author and founder of the Epic Gardening website, podcast, and YouTube channel. Join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Dinner, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kevin Esperito, author and founder of the Epic Gardening website, podcast, and YouTube channel. It focuses, they all focus on urban gardening, and actually reach hundreds of thousands of people every week. So it's great to have him with us. Questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You have experience, as you say, with hydroponics and aquaponics. Maybe explain the differences there between those, Kevin.
Sure, yeah. So hydroponics, if you break down the word, hydro is water, ponos is labor. So it's kind of a method in which the water is doing all the work. And so you're growing without soil, which is the thing that we think plants need the most. But in actuality, they will grow if you provide them with a nutrient solution. So what you do is you have, in a most simple setup for hydroponics, you would have just like a tote, maybe a 25-gallon tote. You fill that up with water. You put some nutrients in there, which is basically just fertilizer for the plants. And then what happens is the plant's roots will grow down into that water. And as long as that water gets some oxygen, sometimes you'll put a little air bubbler in there like you would have in an aquarium. Mm-hmm. As long as that happens and the plant's getting enough light, it really grows quite well and quite fast. For example, maybe a lettuce is a 55-day crop in the soil. In a hydroponic system, I've gotten lettuce fully formed as quickly as 40 to 45 days. So what's really nice about that is if you're in a small space, if you truly don't have any soil to grow in, apartment gardener, that's a really great method. So that's kind of how I started, because when I started, I didn't have any soil. I was growing in a townhouse. The only outdoor space I had was a north-facing covered patio, so pretty much no light at all. So I decided, okay, well, I'm going to have to go indoors and try to grow hydroponically. So that's what I did. Then when you get into the world of aquaponics is a little different, where, remember, in hydroponics, we added water with nutrients. In aquaponics, we add water and fish. We feed the fish with whatever you'd like, some standard fish food. And what the fish do is they'll excrete their waste. Their waste is typically ammonia. Ammonia then goes through a couple different conversions. There's microbes and bacteria in the water that take the ammonia from ammonia to nitrites, and then nitrites to nitrates, and then the nitrates is a nitrogen-based fertilizer, and that's what the plants will eat. And so what happens is you pump that water up into the area where the plants are growing. The plants use it. Effectively, the plants now act as the filter for the tank down below with the fish. And so you can grow both fish and plants at the same time with aquaponics, which is a really cool method.
Yeah. Is this type of gardening accessible, do you think, for the average gardener?
I would say hydroponics, yes, for sure. Actually, hydroponics is used pretty extensively in areas where, you know, water is scarce, in desertified areas. Third world countries are using hydroponics quite a bit to produce food. Aquaponics, I would say a little bit less so. It takes a lot more finesse to condition that whole system. And, you know, typically, if you're doing aquaponics at home, you're an extreme hobbyist. But a lot of people doing aquaponics are doing it at a greenhouse or nursery scale, where they're actually producing for, you know, their actual living.
Yeah, it makes sense. Kathy in Eau Claire has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have a question. We have a big church garden, and we give all our produce away to local pantries. The last 2 years, our bean plants have been chewed to bits, and the beans are coming out okay right now. Last year, they got chewed, too. So we're wondering what might be chewing them and what we might do to take care of it. We don't use any chemicals in our garden at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's difficult to say without knowing the way it's been chewed. I think that's the most important thing to look at is, you know, what is the pattern? If they're being chewed off at the very bottom, at the stalk, then I would be looking into something like maybe a cutworm. But if they're being eaten up on the leaves, I know over here in San Diego, I get a lot of spider mites on my beans. And so typically I'll blast those off with some cold water. They're not a very hardy insect. Once they're off the plant, they kind of just die off. But yeah, there's a couple different pests that are going to hit your beans. Studying the way in which it's being attacked is super helpful. And then honestly, for these localized pest issues, some of the best resources are that local county extension. I call them quite a bit here in San Diego. And there's always someone there who's gardened probably longer than I've been alive, and they have some great suggestions.
Yeah, that's a good piece of advice. As well, Kathy, the University of Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab, you could, if you have photos of the plants, sort of close-up photos of the plants, and maybe if you can see any of the insects or creepy crawlies that are there and get a photo of them, but at least the plants, and send that photo to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. PJ Leash is there, and kind of that's what he does a lot of his day, is answering those kinds of questions from having a good look at sort of what the conditions are. So that's another, either your extension office or the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab would be a good way to go there. And thanks for calling. Pete in Racine, your turn.
Hello.
Hi, Pete.
Yes, in the 1970s, and I saw the reruns in the 1980s, I saw a lot of Mel Bartholomew on television. There was also a man on PBS, other than Mel Bartholomew, who used to spray his garden with a sprayer attachment to his garden hose. Do you recollect the name of that individual? He sprayed, like, beer, sprayed tobacco juice, chewing tobacco, tea, sprayed...
I'm unfamiliar. I'm sorry. I was just a little kid. I didn't even catch Mel's stuff on TV, unfortunately.
Can't help you with that. But did you have something about square foot gardening that you wanted to bring up, Pete?
Well, it was another PBS program. Any of your listeners would really help.
Somebody will probably remember the name of that, Pete, of that person, and call it in, and I'll give it to you over the air. I can't think of who it was. I remember kind of that kind of approach, but I just don't remember the person. So we'll see. We'll get somebody to call in, I'm sure. Jill Nadeau is probably going to get a bunch of calls in the next few minutes from people, and we'll find out. Carol in New Richmond, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. I'm calling with a question on my raspberries. I have an older raspberry group of raspberries, but I have to admit I haven't done real well in the weeding section. I'd like to thin them out, and to be honest with you, I don't get really any berries from them anyway, so maybe that's part of my neglect of them. I'm wondering two things. When can I thin them and maybe make up a new bed? And two, does it have anything to do with maybe my lack of berries and the walnuts trees? I have black walnuts that are about, I'd say, 500 to 700 feet away.
I know black walnuts are pretty nasty as far as their effect on other plants. I'm uncertain if 500 feet, I feel like that would be far enough away personally.
Yeah,
but again,
that should be far enough away.
Yeah.
Although if the leaves blow in,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
there's juglan in every part of that tree. And if you've got leaves or other things, you know, just flying in there and settling in your bed, you're going to could have some problems.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as far as the raspberries, especially if you've never gotten them, I'm just now setting up a raspberry patch as we speak at this new property, and so I'm learning a lot about them. But, you know, as far as I understand, they're not going to produce after that cane. That the canes that come out, they emerge, and they're called primo canes. They form their fruiting buds, and then after that, they'll fruit the next year, and then after that, they never will again. And so once the cane has fruited, you can take it off completely, and that's sort of part of the maintenance of a raspberry patch. It sounds like you might have a lot of those canes going on, and so I might come through and do a pretty serious thin of things that haven't produced that you know have been there for a couple of years, weak ones, all that sort of thing, and see if you can kind of kickstart it back.
All right. Good luck, Carol. Thank you for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Terry in Adams, it's your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I'm calling today, not necessarily about gardening, but I need to move some hostas and is wondering if it's too late to move them in this season.
No.
Hostas. Again, I'm so sorry. I wish some of these plants I had grown, you know, my expertise is mostly small-scale urban gardening, especially vegetables, and so I haven't done a whole lot with hostas either.
But hostas, they're really tough to kill, and you still have enough growing time, I think, Terry, if you want to move them or divide them, a little secret, or not a secret anymore, I've got some hostas in my front lawn area that I just got, they've grown to the point where they're kind of fighting each other. And so I'm going to be dividing them and moving them probably in the next week or so. And you're in Adams. You should have no problem moving them now. So there you go. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Shannon in Shawano emailed or called in to say that the show, the guy that was on that show that our caller was asking about, his name was Jerry Baker. Now that name becomes familiar. Now
there we go.
Jerry Baker. Oh, man. Lee in Richmond, Illinois, emailed, he started Daylily Seeds this spring, and they are currently in pots. Wondering when he can transfer them into the ground. Daylilies.
Daylilies.
Yeah, he should be.
That could have already happened, right?
What's that?
I feel like that could have already, he could have put them in the ground already.
Yeah, he could have, and he could do it now. He's in Richmond, Illinois, and there shouldn't be any problem with transferring them into the ground at this point. I do it sooner than later, actually, so they have time to get established. But in Richmond, Illinois, there's still some growing season left there for sure, and shouldn't be a problem. Well, let's see. We have some other questions here, and I'm trying to find them. But I want to, you know, this whole business about when do we plant or when do we move things. Cold weather is coming here in Wisconsin. Many of us would like to bring plants inside. What advice do you have for keeping those plants healthy when you bring them inside?
Yeah, so I do a little bit of this, and specifically what I'll do is, for me, I'll take my eggplant and pepper varieties that I want to keep for the next year, and I'll take them out of the ground or out of the raised bed, put them in pots, cut them back, and you can actually bring them back the next year. And so you get a quicker, just get a quicker turnaround. You get eggplants and peppers way earlier the next growing season. And so what I try to do is, they're not going to do much, right? We're bringing them inside to protect them. So I try to just give them a little amount of sun, not too much, and just keep those temperatures above, let's say, 60, 65 degrees or so, and just kind of wait it out. And sometimes if we're talking about a plant that isn't going dormant during the winter and it's still growing a little bit, then sometimes I would recommend grabbing some kind of indoor grow light, like maybe even just one of those shop lights that you'd find at the big box store, and supplementing with some additional light, especially if you're growing something out of your zone. If you're trying to, let's say, take care of a tropical plant, but you're in a colder zone, then you definitely have to bring it in. And those plants don't like to stop growing during the winter because they don't have a winter per se. And so sometimes you have to supplement with some additional light or some additional warmth.
Let's take another call. Mike in Waniwak, I believe it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Listening to you folks talk about asparagus plants. Now, as we go around the farm and take them out of the fence line and put them in the beds, they want you to dig this trench, plant the asparagus, cover them and mulch them, but when the birds plant them, they don't dig no trenches. So what's the difference?
Well, when the birds plant them, well, Kevin, go ahead and you make a comment.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think there's a difference between the way that a farmer has determined over years and years is the optimal way to grow a plant versus the way that, you know, natural systems and organisms would plant it, is what I would say. It seems like that is a pretty tried and true method to setting up an asparagus bed, is to trench them out and plant them out that way. But I don't think the birds are able to follow that method.
And I think what happens, Mike, is that when you plant them and follow that trenching method, you're going to get more success, and with you're going to have a lot more plants than if a bird spreads a seed. If birds spread seeds around, those seeds, not a lot of those seeds are going to take hold, let's put it that way. And so it's a much longer process, Mike, if you're doing it, if the birds are doing it versus if you're doing it, for sure. Oh, man. Edie in West Salem, it's your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just curious, I want to start a new bed in my yard where there's plenty of yard grass right now, but we have optimal woods surrounding us. I'm wanting to transplant some of the ferns from the wildwoods into my yard, into a bedded area. Can you do that in the fall? Because they're really hard to find in the spring. And would I cut them back first before I dug them out of the woods?
What do you think? What do you think, Kevin?
Yeah, let me think about that. I think, if they're harder to find in the spring than the fall, then the time I would be experimenting with it at least is right now. So I would at least give it a try. As far as cutting them back, I guess my guess would be I probably wouldn't. I would try to get as much of the root matter out of the ground as I possibly could. I'd make sure and dig a nice big hole in the bed that I want to put it in, and I'd see how it did, kind of watch. And, you know, if temperatures start to get a little colder and it doesn't respond as well, maybe you do cut it back a little bit to help it out. But I'm not quite sure on that. But it sounds like a fun project. It sounds like a cool way to bring the forest into the garden.
Yeah, it would be. One of the things you might have to worry about is, you know, they're growing in that area for a reason, and part of it may have to do with shade because they're under trees. And so if you put them into an exposed area, let's say where you're getting full sun or something, you may have some problems. You may have some problems just because you're moving them from one kind of a little microclimate to perhaps another climate. But you know what? We're all gardeners. What do? We experiment, just as Kevin was saying. So why not give it a shot and see what happens? Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in to 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Gloria in Platteville next. Hi, Gloria.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Appreciate that.
Sure, what's on your mind?
First of all, I have a rhubarb patch, and it generally grows about waist high. It's a great patch. Then what happens is I had leaves surrounding. First of all, I had leaves, for some reason, I had leaves surrounding it. And then all of a sudden, the leaves were gone. And then I had some of my rhubarb gone. So I kind of need to know. And then I'm thinking that rhubarb, the leaves are poisonous. And then I'm thinking, how can I get this rhubarb to kind of come back to life? Because they've kind of taken 50% of my rhubarb. Well, something has. Anyway, it was really, really weird. I never had that happen before. First there was leaves around it, and then the leaves were gone. And then I had...
Can I break in there? Do you mean, were they rhubarb leaves around it, or were there other leaves that were serving as a mulch?
Yeah, just rhubarb leaves.
Okay.
Basically rhubarb leaves surrounding it. And then all of a sudden, the rhubarb leaves left.
Mm.
They were gone. And
so
then...
ate them is what you're saying, right?
I guess. And then some of my rhubarb kind of was gone. But now my rhubarb plants are coming back, but I wanted to know, too. And then I wanted to know, is rhubarb leaves lethal? I see no dead animals around or anything. Insects,
yeah.
Take something, yeah. Like that? Or how do I get it to go back to flourish like it was waist high before?
So you are right. Rhubarb leaves are poisonous in large quantities. They have something that a lot of different plants will have. It's called oxalate, and it causes stomach distress, et cetera. So an animal could eat the rhubarb leaves and be completely fine, depending on the animal, or just like mildly distressed. And so it certainly could be. sometimes it's hard to know unless you actually catch them in the act, right? You don't know if it's an insect or a squirrel or something like that. But again, rhubarb is, I wish I could grow it. It does not do well here at all. It really needs that colder temperature. It does well in the UK. A lot of my friends who grow over there do fine with it. But I wish I had a better tip as far as how to get it to come back. All I know about it is that the stalks are edible and the leaves are not.
And so when you say it's just coming back, just for one more little point on it, Gloria, so the plants are coming back? There are leaves that are coming back? Oh, I think we must have lost her. Uh-oh. So if the leaves are coming back, I just leave it and see what happens.
Let it be, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Gloria, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I don't know.
Okay,
can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yep, you're back.
Okay. Actually, the plant is coming back. There's little bitty plants all over that are coming back. Shoots, like shoots on the ground. So it is coming back. It is reviving, but it was a forced comeback, let me tell you. And it was the weirdest thing ever that happened.
That is where, you know, the good thing is if it was an animal that ate it, they're probably going to figure out pretty fast that they shouldn't eat that again. And so it sounds like it's coming back. I might let it be, let it keep growing and kind of bank on the fact that whatever ate it learned its lesson.
Yeah. Rhubarb is really tough. I mean, it's hard to kill rhubarb, and you can move it around, and I'd let it go and keep an eye on it and see what happens. Gloria. Kathy in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Well, hi there, Larry. Hi there, guests. I'm having problems with my tomatoes. I've had them on the west side of my house for years, but the vacant lot next door now has a two-story house on it, and so now they don't get enough sun. I got these magnificent tomato plants that are like 6 feet tall and green tomatoes, but none of them have changed from green to red. They're very dark green. So I thought, okay, well, I can't really grow the tomatoes there on the west side anymore. So I thought I'm going to maybe do the front side of the house, which faces the south. And I just was wondering, would they get enough sun on the south side? And what should I do to make the dirt better there? It had ewes in there, which we took out. Their burning bush, that one died a couple years ago. And is there anything I could put in the soil there? Would the tomatoes fare better on the south side, knowing that now I can't grow them on the west side of the house anymore?
Yeah. So a quick tip is one thing you can do, especially if your tomatoes aren't ripening up before the fall comes, is especially if you're growing an indeterminate tomato variety, you can actually just clip the top off, because those don't really stop growing until the season kills them. And so by clipping the top, you're telling them, hey, it's time to really throw some energy down into the tomato fruits themselves. And you might get them to ripen up faster that way, the ones you have planted on your west side. So I'd consider that. And then to answer your question about south-facing garden, as long as nothing's blocking you in the south, that's actually the better direction for most of those vegetables, because they're going to be getting sun throughout most of the day. And so I think your tomatoes just in general will do better there. And then as far as improving that soil, I think probably just a good dose of compost, a couple inches of compost worked into the top of the soil is a good start. And see how your tomatoes do. And, you know, you could fertilize your tomatoes next season throughout just to amend if you see things not going the way that you want.
Yeah, that's good advice, I think, Kathy. Thank you very much for calling. Our guest today is Kevin Esperito. He is an author and founder of the Epic Gardening website, podcast, and YouTube channel. Focuses on urban gardening and reaches hundreds of thousands of people every week, as a matter of fact. There's a lot of vegetable gardening. It's great to have him with us. Certainly join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kevin Esperito, author, founder of the Epic Gardening website, podcast, and YouTube channel. It's great to have him along, and certainly questions. I hope you'll join in. Lots of callers online, as a matter of fact, Kevin. So let's go to Lily in La Crosse next. Hi, Lily.
Hi, Kevin and Larry. It's nice to talk to you.
Nice to have you with us.
I have a question about lettuce and spinach. I have little white spots all over them. I've had some slug damage as well, and I was wondering what causes those little white spots. Is that from the slugs, or is that something else that's happening?
I think most of the time that's a little bit of a fungal issue. It's like a white rust type of thing that can go on there. It looks like almost like it got bleached a little bit. Is that correct?
Well, it's tiny little spots. It just looks like there's no, the green is gone from those tiny little spots, and it's just like tiny, tiny spots over the whole leaf.
That's what, so I mean, that would be what my intuition would be saying. You might have another pest going on if you're seeing. Yeah, it couldn't be a leaf miner, because those like to give more of a trail type of white spot. Could be something like a flea beetle, but again, my intuition would be pointing me towards something in the disease area, some sort of rust or fungal issue there.
Yeah, I think so, too. You might, what you could do, I mentioned earlier the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW, but there's also the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, PDDC. But if you type in Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, Brian Huddleston directs that. And if you take a photo, close-up photo of the leaves, he may well be able to give you additional information about it. And that's a free service. You just take a photo, send that photo to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW, and he'll have some more. But I think Kevin's probably right, but he may be able to tell you, because likely he's seen this many times already from other people and probably has a quick answer. So give that a shot too, Lily. Diane in Maquantico, your turn. Hi, Diane.
I have a question about, I have container gardens because I have it on an old pool deck, and the rest of my lot is all shaded, so this is where I have the sun. I do really well with tomatoes, peppers, I've got green beans, you know, everything does well, except cucumbers. I get a lot of vine, I get a lot of blossoms, and I never get any cucumbers. Like, this year I've had two cucumbers, so I was wondering what I could possibly do. Is there a different variety? Should I try a bush versus a vine? I just never get any cucumbers.
But you get a lot of vine.
Yeah, I get vine and I get a lot of blossoms, but I never get any cucumbers.
That could be a couple different things. Yeah, I mean, if you're getting a lot of vine and not a lot of cucumbers, one issue could be that you've got a fertilizer imbalance that's kind of pushing out a lot of the vegetative growth and not a lot of flowers. But it sounds like you're saying you do get flowers, but they just don't turn into cucumbers, right?
I just don't get, because I have tons of blossoms, but I never get the cucumbers.
Okay, well then in that case, I would say the most likely problem is that the flowers themselves are not getting pollinated, and so they're not actually having the opportunity to become a cucumber. So something you can do if you want to is you can hand pollinate. So you can take a male flower, which is the one that does not have a tiny baby cucumber behind it, just a thin stem. You can take that off, and then you can put it right up into the female flower, and you can pollinate it yourself. It helps a lot, especially if you're growing in an area where there's not a lot of native pollinators, bees, et cetera, around to do that, especially with a cucumber plant. You know, tomato, self-pollinating, it'll be completely fine. It has both the male and the female in the same flower, but most cucumbers do not. And so that's probably what's going on there.
Yeah, and that's a good tip to look and look at those flowers. They may be all males, too.
Yeah, that happens sometimes as well. Sometimes the males come out before.
Yeah, but that's a good trick. Diane, give that a shot and see what happens. Appreciate your call. Joe in Monticello, your turn. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I've got a very, very good raised bed garden full of tomatoes, and I understand you're not supposed to plant tomatoes continuously. Is that correct?
I mean, I think in your guys' zone, generally speaking, you would have one really long, good crop of tomatoes, and that's about it.
Yeah.
So next year, no tomatoes. How about the year after?
I think I understand what you're saying now. You can completely plant tomatoes year after year in the same spot if you want to.
Okay.
Unless you get some really terrible disease in there, you may want to move it.
Yeah. I would say if you know for a fact you have blight in that soil, early blight or alternaria or any one of these number of diseases, it might be a good idea to swap it to an area that does not have that problem and then use a plant in the area your tomatoes were that doesn't suffer from those soil diseases. But from the perspective of can you grow tomatoes in the same spot year after year, you totally can as long as you're not dealing with some of those nasty diseases.
Yeah. And a good thing to do at the end of the season is to get those plants out of there and get the leaves, remove the old product there, the old leaves and the old plant and just get it out of there, put it in a compost pile. And that also then helps prevent some of those things from lingering. If there is a little of it one year and if you leave them there, the plants there or the leaves there, they can then make it worse the next year. I have found that out.
I have too.
Joe, good luck. Thank you. Mary and Almond, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Oh, yes. Good morning. Thanks, Larry and your guest. I was listening to the person that wasn't getting cucumbers, and that's something that I had in my garden, and I couldn't figure it out. I mean, I'd see the blossoms and nothing. And so I started using a Sherman live trap and caught several white-footed mice and several meadow voles. And once they were out of the garden, then I started getting cucumbers.
Oh, there you go. That's clever. I would never have thought of that.
All right. So get the mouse traps out.
Right. There you go.
Thanks, Mary. Appreciate it. And Dennis in Aslin, Minnesota, your turn. Hi.
Oh, yes. Hi, Larry and Kevin and everyone. Two questions here. I raise a variety of vegetables in my garden, and I'm wondering every time I thin them out, the kohlrabi, the carrots, the radishes, and the beans and all that, I'm wondering which of those thinnings might be edible, if your guess is up on that one. And then along that line, too. Okay, I'll listen a little bit here.
Yeah, sure. So all of them, in short, are edible. The kohlrabi can best be thought of as like a broccoli or cabbage type of flavor and completely edible, the tops. Carrots, if you want it, it depends on when you thin them. The carrot tops are totally edible, just kind of tastes like a salad version of a carrot, I guess is the best way I could put it. But if you thin them when they've started to form a tiny little taproot, you can get at least a little bit of a crunch with those small carrots. And radish tops as well. Most of the tops of turnips, beets, in fact, beet greens are some of my favorite greens in general. So sometimes I grow beets just for their greens. So to answer that question, all those are edible if you want to throw them in a little summer salad.
Yeah. And you had another question, Dennis?
Yes. Well, that's good news. It's good to have. And secondly, I've got white clover in the garden, and I know white clover kicks out nitrogen. And if that's edible, is there a best time to pull that if I want to pull it? Would that not disturb the nitrogen content?
Yeah, I think, typically when I'm growing anything that has any kind of clover, it's mostly because I want to improve the soil, so I let it actually grow, live its life, die out, and then all that plant matter I end up just putting back into the soil. But it is completely edible, again. So I would experiment with that. You can use the leaves in salads. You can dry them. The flowers actually are sometimes used as tea. So a lot of different things you can use for that as well.
And why not?
Yeah. Yeah, there's enough of it, I'm sure, in the garden. I mean, you could save some and eat the rest.
Well, some of those seeds, you know, when you plant, they're so small, it's impossible to get them spaced properly.
Yep.
So
when you look at carrots, a lot of people will just plant carrots in a little furrow and worry about thinning later and not try to get the spacing perfect right out of the gate.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Dennis, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, and good luck eating those thinned plants from the garden. That's a good thing to do. Well, Kevin Esperito is our guest today, author and founder of the Epic Gardening website, podcast, and YouTube channel. So it's Epic Gardening is the name of the podcast, website, and YouTube channel. And he focuses on urban gardening and, of course, reaches hundreds of thousands of people every week. And he's here with us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending some of your Friday time with us today on the Ideas Net. Been talking with Kevin Esperito, the founder of the Epic Gardening website, podcast, and YouTube channel. And he's the author of the book Field Guide to Urban Gardening, How to Grow Plants No Matter Where You Live. Questions for him? Give a call. 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Appreciate your calls and your emails. Let's take another call. We've got Jeffrey in Vancouver, Washington, up next. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I had a question about a rain barrel I got on the cheap because it was used as a canola oil container. And I was just wondering how much I need to sanitize out the canola oil before I use it for watering the plants in the garden.
That's a good question. I mean, I think the good thing is it's food safe because it was storing canola oil, so you're good to go there. But I would just try to use some soap and clean it out until there's no sort of residue of the canola. Give it a good rinse and you should be good to go.
Yeah, I don't see any problem there. A little soapy water in there and rinse it out and you should be just fine. Even if there's a little bit of that oil in there, it's not going to hurt anything.
I agree.
Good luck, Jeff. Thank you. John in Dodgeville, your turn. Hi, John.
Good morning. Hey, I've got to start a garden next spring, and so I wanted to prep this fall for it. Looking for any suggestions.
So what have you got? Go ahead. I'm sorry, Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, I think we're going to ask the same question. Is what kind of setup are you thinking about? Are you doing a raised bed? Are you doing it in the ground?
In the ground garden, it's currently a grassy field. I've killed off the grass in it, and I plan on tilling it up this fall or this summer, and probably multiple times. And prepping it for spring.
Yeah, what I would probably do in that case is I would probably do my final till, and then I would work in a decent amount of organic matter. Again, whatever you've got local, compost is, of course, usually the go-to there, but you know, things like chicken manure, horse manure, all that stuff is perfectly fine. Even just leaves, grass clippings, till all that in, form up your bed. I would throw a couple inches of mulch on top and I just let it be until the spring.
Yeah, that's very good. If you were worried about the soil at all, you could do a little soil test, the soil and plant analysis laboratory, and for a few bucks, you could send a soil sample in and tell them you want a garden in that area, a vegetable garden, and they'll give you a little recommend. They'll give you, they'll tell you what nutrients are there, whether they're enough of them and or what you might need to amend. But I think, you know, Kevin's advice is probably pretty darn good too. Thanks for very much. Good luck. Good to know you're starting a garden. Jane in Wisconsin Rapids, your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hello. I'm hoping for some advice about a lemon and a lime tree. Right now they're in a pot outside. They get sun most of the day. And I have two questions. I wonder what they need for soil, sun, and water because they're not thriving. And then what would keep them happy when they come inside for the winter?
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. So now these are up my alley because we grow a lot of citrus out here. What you're going to want to do is, in a perfect world, and you know, of course, it's difficult sometimes to grow plants outside of their zone, but you know, lemons, limes, they're going to want as much sun as you could humanly give them, especially in your area, so the sunniest possible location. The soil, they don't want to have, we call it wet feet, they don't want their roots to be sort of soaked in water. And in fact, sometimes they even benefit a little bit from having some drought-like conditions. So I really would wait to water until that soil is dry to maybe 3 to 5 inches down, then give it a nice healthy soak. And as far as soil, the biggest thing, especially if they're in containers, is to make sure that those containers have drainage holes at the bottom. A lot of the times, if they don't, even if you don't water them too much, that water still can sit in there and that can cause them to just have a failure to thrive. And so that's what I would say. As far as bringing them in your area, you definitely will need to bring them in and give them as much light as you can possibly give them indoors. Because again, you know, in their native environment, there isn't really a true winter. And so they're still benefiting from decently high temperatures, 65 to 75 degrees sometimes. You know, over here, we'll get lemons fruiting in November, December sometimes. And so that's what I would say for lemons and limes.
Yeah, and if you, I have a lime tree, limey, my lime tree, that when the lime tree comes in, I give some extra lights, light to it. And I'm always amazed. You'll be surprised how it'll flower once it comes in. Mm-hmm. When you have to bring it in, they just flower like crazy right after you bring them in. At least mine does, so...
Yeah, I've noticed they sometimes flower almost as if they're stressed. I've had some that have dropped leaves because of moving or whatever, and then their response is always to throw tons and tons and tons of flowers out.
Yeah, there you go, Jane. Thank you very much for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. Melinda in Green Bay, your turn. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon to you. My question to you is, what is the best way to make a compost pile? And how long before you can use the compost in the garden?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a lot of different ways to do it. Are you thinking about the standard one where the compost pile heats up and eventually breaks down really quickly?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So because sometimes I'll compost and I'll just leave it in a pile and I won't really turn it, and that'll be sort of a passive way to do it. But if you want to go fast, the way that I've done it, if you want to go on the cheap, is just get some 2x4 lumber, and you can frame up it needs to at least be 3x3x3 feet, so 1 cubic yard of space, because if you don't have that much organic matter, it really won't get to that point where the middle of the pile starts to heat up. And so that's kind of the minimum as far as the volume. And then from there, you want to layer your ingredients. So there's all sorts of different formulas and recipes. And I think some of them kind of overcomplicated a little bit. I try to put in roughly 2 parts of brown material to about 1 part of green material. Brown would be a dead leaf, shredded twigs, bark, things like that. And green materials would be your fresh grass clippings, your fresh leaves, your food scraps, and things like that. And you layer those in, add some water each layer. It's good to build those piles all at once, because if you fill it halfway, it really, again, it doesn't have enough material to kind of get that process started. So build that pile all at once. And then from there, you should start to see it heat up really nicely. If you were to dig into the middle of the pile, you'd see some steam start to come out. You could get a cheap compost thermometer, stick it down in there, should be at least about 120 degrees or so, if not up into the 140, 150 range. And then from there, you're really good to go. I would say it really does depend on a lot of different factors as far as how soon you can get it. You do have to manage that pile, turn it every now and then. But I would say within no sooner than about 3 months, you could get it. And it's an ongoing process from there.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Let's go to Karen in La Crosse next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thanks, Larry. Thanks, Kevin. My question, I've been so glad to have a gardener who gardens in a warmer climate, because my question has to do with germinating beets and Swiss chard for the second time. So I grow beets, and they germinate really well in April, May. And then I was following a gardener's blog named Megan from Madison, and she says, you know, plant your crops, you know, early August for your second go-around so that you harvest them in November. And I cannot get beets or Swiss chard to germinate. I soak the seeds 24 hours. The soil is really soft. But I just wonder, in a warmer climate, do you have problems germinating what we could consider a cold season vegetable?
Yeah, so what's really interesting about those two is it's just kind of a funky seed. You know, it is an odd seed. Typically, I don't have too many problems with it. Granted, I actually start my beets and my chard in trays. I don't direct sow it. Are you direct sowing your beets and chard?
I'm direct sowing it. Yep, I am.
Yeah, so that's probably the change I would make for your fall. Sounds like you have no problem in spring, which is fantastic. But in fall or in that late August, I would go ahead and try to germinate them in trays and transplant them in. That way you can control your soil temperature a little bit more, and then you should have some success. But I think I might have problems if I direct sowed it, because I am in that warmer climate. But I like the control of, you know, knowing exactly how and when my seeds are started. And so I end up doing it in a tray, and then I just pop them out and transplant them in. And, you know, contrary to what most people think, you can pretty much start anything in a tray. A lot of people say, you know, only direct sow certain crops. Yeah, I mean, maybe carrots, things like that. But you'd be surprised what you can germinate in a tray and transplant it out.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go back to the rhubarb, the caller who had lost her leaves and wondered what the heck happened. And you and I were wondering too. And
yeah.
Sue in Eau Claire called to say that in years when grasshoppers are plentiful, they can eat rhubarb down. Yeah, and that's true. I'm seeing some grasshoppers around my yard here too. And they can eat rhubarb down, but of course, rhubarb being rhubarb, it'll come back. So,
right.
But right. that was a good tip for sure. Let's take a call from John in Janesville. Hi, John.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Good. I'm calling. I just want your guest's recommendation on the ratio or the material that should go into a raised bed. And I don't know if you've answered this, I just started listening, but his recommendation on the material and the ratio of material in a raised bed or a garden bed, garden box.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, let's tackle that one. There's actually a lot of different recipes that people recommend. So I'll give you a couple and you can kind of pick and choose which one works for you. So the first would be the one I learned when I first started, and that would be Mel Bartholomew's Mel's Mix. So the great thing about this one is it works really, really well. The downside of this one is it's kind of expensive. And so I'll go through the mix. It's 1/3 vermiculite, which you can buy at any big box store, garden center, 1/3 compost, and 1/3 peat moss. You can substitute for coconut coir there. It's kind of the same thing. So that works pretty well. If you want to go a little on the cheap and still effective, you can do something where you just dig up some of your native soil, so about 50% topsoil, then you can do 25% compost and 25% of any other organic matter, including compost, but you could use, you know, leaves, you know, worm castings, grass clippings, things like that. And that's a pretty good mix that will get better and better and better over the years. And that one's a lot cheaper than going with a prepared mix like the Mel's mix.
Yeah. John, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Carol in Crandon, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi, I was listening to your comments about tomato plants. I have some pear tomatoes and some orange-colored cherry tomatoes. The orange-colored cherry tomatoes are getting ripe and are doing wonderfully well. The smaller pear tomatoes are remaining very green, and I had heard that you were mentioning something about taking off some of the leaves and knowing whether a tomato plant was determinate or indeterminate, and I'm not sure what these pear tomatoes are, frankly. So I wondered if you could give me some advice about that. I also have, in the last couple of weeks, I have tomato blight, which I've had before.
You're not the only one.
I think we all have tomato blight at some point. But, okay, so for your pear tomatoes, did you start those from seed, or were those something that you bought from a nursery?
I bought them from a very good nursery, and they're really, you know, have a lot of tomatoes and are, you know, they're all green, but they're really thriving.
Sure. So is the tomato plant pretty tall, like 4, 5, 6 feet tall?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah? Okay. So there's a good chance that's an indeterminate tomato variety. You could always just give that nursery a call and say, hey, that pear tomato you sold me, can you let me know if it's determinate or indeterminate? Most of us are growing indeterminates, and really it's just a difference of how the tomato wants to grow. On a determinate, it ends up topping itself out because its final tip at the growing tip is actually a flower bud, and so it doesn't have any ability to grow further. Indeterminates will just keep growing until the season kills them off. And so, again, something you could do with those pears, if it is an indeterminate, is clip off the growing tip at the top, because we really don't care at this point in the season that it puts out more flowers and more fruit. We kind of just want the ones that are already on the plant to ripen up. So that's one thing that you can do. And usually that tends to work, and sometimes you just have to be a little bit more patient with it.
Mm-hmm. I've heard from more than one person that their tomatoes are later than normal and are green turning.
It's interesting how every season there's some nuance to it, right? I mean, for us here, it's been dealing with the ability to have basically two full seasons of summer. And so how and when do you decide to plant that? And how do you manage the heat? We're having crazy heat right now. And there's always some little nuance to the season, it seems like, no matter how experienced you get.
Yeah, for sure. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is regarding cucumbers and the cucumber blight, or the frosting that it gets on it. I plant my cucumber generally in the same spot every year, and they usually get their that white powdery, I forget that.
Powdery mildew.
Powdery mildew, yes. So I usually get that in the fall every year, but this year it came in like beginning of July, and I had gotten almost no cucumbers, and I'm wondering if, do I need to treat this like a tomato blight where I need to constantly plant them in different areas to try and halt this? Mildew.
I mean, man, that's a tricky one because powdery mildew spores are in the air, and so it's a lot trickier to get rid of it. I would say if you've got a lot of space and you can really relocate them, it's worth a shot. But it's a lot harder to deal with that one than the blights because most of those blights are hanging out in the soil, and powdery mildew typically is kind of just everywhere. One of our biggest issues down here where I grow as well, and I've been seeing little spots cropping up and trying to treat it as well. So it's a tough one. Crop rotation is a little bit less effective in that case, unfortunately.
but we have a lot of powdery mildew every year in Wisconsin, and it's
yeah
Well, especially depending on, you know, you get a lot of rain, you have wet spells, and following that, you tend to wind up with powdery mildew, and that's too bad. So what's coming up on your, Kevin, what have you got coming up on your website and your podcast and your YouTube channel?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, most of what I'm doing now is I'm kind of just documenting how I'm building out this new homestead. And so the goal with this place is to showcase a lot of different methods, not just the raised bed urban gardening that I was doing before, but, you know, orchard trees, small backyard orchard management, how to actually maybe grow enough food to live off of with some root crops and things like that, even getting into canning, preserving, and more of a still urban, because I'm still in pretty urban San Diego, but, you know, if you're living in just the typical American home, is it possible to grow a significant amount of your own food? And so that's kind of what I'm covering lately and just chronicling that journey, because, again, I just moved into this space. In fact, Monday is the final move day, so by Monday I'll actually be fully moved in. So it's been a summer of transition over here, and it's been really exciting to, you know, just try to transform this space and show everyone how I'm doing it, hopefully in a way that helps them as well.
Yeah, for sure. And what Grant emailed, when is the best time to pick vegetables? For example, should you pick cucumbers when they are deep green or wait for that?
Cukes are tricky because there's, you got your pickling cukes and then you got like your slicing cukes. And so it kind of depends on which one there, but yeah, that's a hard one to answer. Cukes are almost the hardest one to answer there because there's so many different varieties too, you know?
Yeah.
Some of them never turn deep green. I would say for that one, it's not going to be a satisfying answer, but, you know, look at the variety that you planted and it'll tell you on the seed packet how long roughly those fruits end up at. And so when you see it get to around that point, I would cut it and I would let it go and give it a taste test, see if you like it. And if it's a little bit too bitter, maybe that was a little too late and you start picking them a little earlier. That one's almost a trial and error thing.
Kevin, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Appreciate you being with us today. And good luck with your new place.
Thanks, Larry. I think I'm going to need it. I appreciate it.
Kevin Esperito, he's got a big new property to work on, and you're going to be able to see a lot of his effort if you go to his Epic Gardening website or podcast and YouTube channel, which focuses on urban gardening and does reach hundreds of thousands of people every week. Kevin Esperito, fun talking with him today on the Ideas Network. Just to let you know, starting on Monday, we're making some changes to our program schedule on the Ideas Network. So you'll find both 1A and On Point at new times, plus a few new shows and some other changes. So take a listen. Let us know what you think. And you can find complete details on our website at wpr.org/fall2020, wpr.org/fall2020. And if you'd like to hear more about our guests or show topics, be sure to check out our new blog. Just go to wpr.org/Larry to see what's there. And Monday we'll be talking with Mike Bino from Wisconsin Magazine and the weather guys too. Stay with us. Have a good weekend. Lots in store on the Ideas Net. I'm Larry Mueller.